Good afternoon. It's 10 minutes after 1. We're going to call to order the resource meeting. In attendance are Representative Olson, Representative Crawford, Representative Ledoux, Representative Elkins, Representative Seaton, myself, Chair Ramirez. I'm sitting at the resource table with us today is our friend Representative Moses, and in the back of the room is Representative Hawker, who's here with us for a little bit. We're going to take up again today House Concurrent Resolution 29, sponsored by Representative Hawker. Our intention today is to take public testimony and to hear from Northern Dynasty and anybody else in the room that is interested in commenting on this. When we left things last Friday, I had wanted to begin this meeting with a presentation, a 10-minute presentation by DNR, who is going to lay down a side-by-side for us so we could make a determination as to what is the due diligence of DNR in permitting this, and then whether this HCR 29 is done concurrently or if there are elements of it that are redundant, because there seemed to be, certainly I was confused about it, and there seemed to be some confusion around this table as to the nature of what the fiscal note attached to this was going to take up that wasn't otherwise covered, because it's a resolution, and so it's a bit unusual to see a significant fiscal note. Representative Gatto has joined us. Do we have anybody from DNR online yet? Ed, are you with us?
Yes.
Yes, we do, Representative Ramirez. Up in Anchorage, we have Ed Fogles, myself, Ed Fogles, Deputy Commissioner of DNR. We have Dick Milius, Director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, and Tom Crawford, the state's mining coordinator.
Great. Do you have anything prepared? Did you do a PowerPoint or anything that you is being sent to us that we can, that the members can look at while you explain to us the distinction between DNR's normal path of due diligence or its critical path, and what else is required to do the fiscal note here for HCR 29?
No, I apologize. I don't have a PowerPoint that I was able to get down to the committee this afternoon, but I am prepared to, along with Dick Milius, to go through and explain the differences between our permitting process and the state's land management planning process.
Is there anything written that you can provide us?
I can provide you something, but I do not think I can get it to you today.
Don't waste the time.
I thought we were clear on that on Friday, that that was the way we were going to start this meeting. So I have to tell you that I'm embarrassed as the resource chair, and I mean, you're a terrific professional, but I feel like I'm talking to somebody who didn't do their homework over the weekend. I did mine. With that, if you would go ahead and proceed with an oral explanation, and we'll do the best that we can in putting this together.
Okay, my apologies again, Mr. Chair. I'd like to start off by a brief explanation of the state's large mine permitting process, and then I will turn it over to Dick Milius, who will sort of run through the state's land management planning process.
Do you have somebody there that can take some notes that's in DNR concurrently so you can fax us your notes so that we'll have a document after you give your oral presentation, please?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you. Proceed, please.
The Alaska Department of Natural Resources is mandated by state statute to be the coordinating agency for large mining projects. And within the Department of Natural Resources Office of Project Management and Permitting, we have the Large Projects Group. And in that office resides our mining coordinator, who is currently Mr. Tom Crawford. And that person's job is to coordinate all state agencies that are involved in permitting of large mining projects, and those agencies include the Department of Environmental Conservation, all the divisions of natural resources, the Department of Fish and Game, Transportation, Public Facilities, the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and the Department of Law. We have a core group of state officials that have been working on large mine projects for most of them for over 15 years now, and they have done permitting work on projects starting back in the AJ days, worked on Fort Knox, True North, Pogo, Kensington. We've done permitting work on Greens Creek and Red Dog. So it's a huge body of expertise that's held in this team. I don't know how many years cumulative experience the group has, but they're all they all have advanced degrees in engineering, hydrology, chemistry. I just have to emphasize that we have a very experienced team that runs through the permitting process. Now, a typical large mine project such as Pogo will take about 50 permits to actually permit the project, both state and federal. So there's a huge job to try and coordinate these permits. And these permits range from a reclamation plan approval, which ensures that the mine actually reclaims the property in a sound way, and ensures that the money is set aside so that the state can do the reclamation if the mining company should not be able to for whatever reason. These permits also include permits to make sure that any dam or structure on the property doesn't leak and is technically sound. Permits include air quality permits, waste disposal permits, a huge variety of permits. So that's the job of the mining coordinator to make sure that all these agencies bring these permits together in a coordinated fashion. Typically, even the application for a large mine project may take up several bookshelves on a bookcase. So it's very technically oriented, and every little detail is, as Commissioner Menge said last week, is ground down to talcum powder and examined from every conceivable angle. The mining team not only gets to permit the project, but once the project is permitted, if it is permitted, then the mining team follows up and will do the enforcement, the compliance, the monitoring of the project for many, many years to come, as we are doing at Red Dog, Greens Creek, Fort Knox, and True North. I also need to explain that if any federal permit is required, such as a clean water permit or a wetlands permit, that typically an environmental impact statement is required and NEPA is invoked. And that is pretty much the case with any large mine project today. And the NEPA process is very lengthy. It takes many years to put together an environmental impact statement. And so the state of Alaska has learned how to dovetail into the federal EIS process and plug ourselves into that process. And that process is very similar to, in a lot of respects, to our land management process, which I'll let Dick explain to you in a minute. But the important aspects are there are at least two rounds of public meetings and three rounds of public involvement in a typical environmental impact statement process. The whole process starts off with an analysis of the issues, and then there's a data gathering phase where all baseline information is put together and compiled, and then alternatives are developed that allow the agencies to compare the environmental impacts from the different alternatives, and including the no action alternative. And at the end of that, a draft EIS is produced and put out for public notice once again. And the state agencies use this document, which is often thousands of pages long, to help base our permitting decisions off of. So we don't actually issue any permits until after the environmental impact statement process has run its course and the environmental impact statement has been completed. So that, in a nutshell, is the large mine permitting process, as is dovetailed with the NEPA process. And we envision that if a project such as Pebble were to go forward, this would be the process that would be followed, and that it would be a multiple year process. So now I'd like to turn it over to Dick, so he can briefly go over the land management planning process and explain to you how that might parallel or dovetail in with the EIS process.
Representative and members of the committee, my name is Dick Milius. I'm the acting director of the DNR Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Our standard planning process begins with identifying issues where we hold public meetings and ask folks what their concerns are. This is very similar to the scoping process that's used in the EIS and the large mine projects, and we envision that would be one and the same process at that step. The next step in the planning process is based on those issues to identify or to collect data that will help address those questions. Again, we envision using the data collection that's being used as part of both the large mine and EIS process. So we don't envision a major data collection effort just for the land use plan. The next step in the planning process is to develop plan alternatives where you look at what the different options are for land management in an area. And at this step, we usually have some sort of public involvement. It's not always necessarily public meetings, but it might be workshops or it might be some sort of public attitude survey on the alternatives or whatever. And based on that, we select essentially a preferred alternative, which we call the draft plan, which is similar to what goes into the draft EIS as a proposed action. And at that point, we have public meetings on the draft plan, and then we compile all those public comments and issue a final plan, which would be fairly similar and at the same time as we would issue a final environmental impact statement. And there's usually some sort of public review of that. Again, it kind of depends on the magnitude of the project and the types of changes we've made from the draft to the final as to whether or not we actually hold public meetings or some less significant public involvement process. Then from that, we adopt a final plan, which reflects the changes from the public comment period and all that. Then if anyone objects to that, they can appeal that plan first to the commissioner, and then if they don't like the decision of the commissioner, they could appeal it to court. I think we only had one of our land use plans actually appeal, though, to the courts in the past. And then once any appeals are resolved, we can implement the plan. And so the planning process and the EIS process are very much similar processes in terms of step-by-step.
All right, Dick, let me interrupt you then. This is what I'm particularly interested in. You guys have done a fine job of detailing what the DNR program is. What is with the fiscal note? Does it happen concurrently? Is it extra? Is it redundant to this process? Explain the $400,000 fiscal note to me, please.
Mr. Chairman, the fiscal note is that it would run, we envision process-wise running concurrently, but we would prepare a different document. We don't do a land use plan as part of the large mine and NEPA process. It'd actually be a separate document we'd have to produce that would be our planning staff as opposed to our permitting staff. And it would be more of a kind of, I guess the main work difference and product difference is that it would be kind of the NEPA process is, as Ed mentioned, a very long, detailed document. And this would more summarize a lot of that information or compile it into kind of one planning document. And we'd have to get separate public, the process would be combined with this, but we'd have to address public comments separate from this or maybe not necessarily separate, but there'd be different issues the public would raise. For example, we might get into the plan might address more of some of the uses on some of the adjacent lands that may not actually get addressed in the EIS in as great a detail.
Dick? Dick?
So it's kind of it's going to be a separate public commenting process. Right? It'll occur concurrently, but we'll have to respond to all those comments come in specific to the plan. And one of the reasons for the fiscal note is that we envision with this process in particular that it'd be a fairly contentious process, and we get an awful lot of public comments we need to address through the whole process.
Dick, if I can interrupt you, this is where you've lost me. It's 1:25 now. At 2:45, we want to come back to you, and I'd like to have something that's written up that's side by side so that I can understand in big, broad brushstrokes what's involved. You did a fine job of explaining the critical path for permitting permitting the large mine permitting process. I want to understand what side by side is incorporated in this the land use plan and what is generating the fiscal note on HCR 29. So if you could prepare something on paper and fax it to fax it to our office. We're at 465-2070, 465-2070. And if you can do that in the next hour, we'll come back to it at 2:45 and take it up so that the members can understand, or at least I can understand, exactly what is generating the fiscal note and the augmentation to the regular DNR plan, because I think it's critical for us to understand that. I want to get on to testimony very briefly. Are there any questions for DNR? Because we will come back to them at 2:45 today. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I had one that I wanted to ask, and that revolves around the last page, the last sentence of the of HCR 29, where it says the commissioner's conclusion regarding the appropriateness of classifying the area encompassing Pebble Copper Deposit for mineral development. I'm trying to figure out what the alternatives there are in a land use plan, and I presume that the alternative is a different classification, such as recreational or some other usage. And so my question comes down to, if we would go through a land use planning process that reclassifies this this mining district for something else, and we have permitted and encouraged mining claims and expenditures to delineate that amount, are we looking at a takings claim? I know that when we were doing the coal bed methane leases in Homer area, which were fairly small, we were looking at up to $100 million based on the, not on what was expended, but what was the potential recoverable amount. And I'm wondering if this went through a land use reclassification that did not permit the development of the mineral leases that, or mineral claims that we've allowed, would we have a takings claim, and what would be the potential amount of that takings?
Representative Seaton, to the chair, this is Dick Milius. Three responses to that. The first one is, generally in management plans, we don't do wholesale reclassifications. One of the distinctions between our different levels of planning, our more broad level of planning, which is called area plans, deal with 1 to 15 million acres of state land generally, and lay out the general management intent. In the Bristol Bay Area Plan, which was revised just last year, a large part of the area that is occupied by the mining claims that are affected here is in an area that's designated minerals. And like I said, that's the area plan. A management plan is a step-down plan that focuses on a smaller geographic area and deals with more specific issues and gets into greater detail within that area. And as a general rule, a management plan doesn't change the overall intent from an area plan. So the first answer is that we don't envision through a management plan that we would do a wholesale reclassification. That being said, my second point would be that even if we do a wholesale reclassification, all state land is open to mineral entry under state law unless specifically closed by the legislature. Through our land use planning process, even if we classify a chunk of land recreation, it is still under statute open to mineral entry. Under statute, the commissioner can only close up to 640 acres of land from mineral entry, and this is obviously a lot larger than 640 acres. So even if we did reclassify the land, it would still be classified multiple use, open to mineral entry. There might be more restrictions put on how it's mined, but there could not be a prohibition of mining through a management plan. And then the third point, getting to your issue of a takings, there are valid mining claims out there, so no matter what we did through land use planning, or even no matter what the legislature did, there are still valid existing mining claims there. And even if we close the area to mineral entry, any mineral closing order done by either DNR or even by the legislature is always subject to valid existing rights. And so the existing mining claims would be considered a valid existing right. And if the legislature, DNR could not prohibit any development of the mining claims. We could restrict the mining claims, but we could never, through the planning process, nor through any other administrative procedure, classify the land in such a way that those mining rights go away. And the legislature may have that authority, but then they could very well get into a takings claim if they want it. It'd be similar to the Kachemak Bay oil and gas leases quite a few years ago, where the state actually leased an area for oil and gas, and subsequently the legislature came in and closed it. And in those cases, yeah, somebody could advance a takings claim.
All right. Let me recognize that my friend Representative Kapsner come in, Representative Gatto, Chair Samuels has come in. Representative Ledoux, I know you have a question. What I'm interested in is the side-by-side sheet. That was the presentation we wanted. You'll get that to us in the next hour and be available for us at 2:45 so that we can follow up on that. I'd be grateful. We've got a lot of people in this room, and then I've got 30-some-odd people, 20, 30 people at the various LIOs and off-nets here, and we want to, this is just a resolution, we want to try and proceed through this. And Northern Dynasty has been very kind in letting us get to public testimony first, but I want to get Northern Dynasty on the record for at least 15 minutes today to kind of give us an overview of this project from their perspective. In deference to some of the folks that we have signed up here to speak, we have the Glenn Allsworth, the mayor of the Lake and Penn Borough. If you're here, Mayor Allsworth, we'd be delighted to hear from you. And although I'm going to ask for testimony for 2 minutes, Mr. Mayor, certainly we'll accord you some more time, as we will Commissioner O'Clery and anybody else who thinks that it's very relevant for them to spend an extra couple of minutes. Please ask for it at the beginning of your testimony. Mr. Mayor, welcome to the House Resources Committee. We're honored to have you travel so far, and we appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and distinguished representatives. I'm pleased to be here. I have just a few points. My comments will be short. I want to make some comments regarding our area. We live on clean water and good fish, and that's dear to the hearts of all of us there. And so I want to start by prefacing my remarks that we're not willing to sacrifice that, but I come personally from a stance that development and environment can coexist if it's done right. And that's why I would preface my remarks. Another place that I stand is I hear a lot of talk about no net loss. Well, I don't really buy into no net loss. What I want to buy into is net gain. I don't think we have to stand for simply a wash, no net loss. I think we could enhance and come out ahead whenever we do projects. And I stand from that aspect in our area, too. I have been very pleased that we have experienced the largest public process that I've ever been involved in regards to this proposal and all the studies that's going on. Never in my history of that area has any agency or any entity come in with such an incredible process of public involvement. And in our little community, which is on Lake Clark, we've had several meetings there. Even when the National Park was created, Lake Clark National Park, they didn't have any kind of meetings to the magnitude and extent that we're having now, and I'm pleased with that. And so I want to promote the public process and let the process work. And we really appreciate that. Our villages, I believe, they're either going to go to work or die. And if you can imagine the long-term effect of no economic opportunity, we see this played out in our many rural areas with a lot of people living in hopelessness and helplessness and depression because they're not worried about where to spend next year's vacation. They're trying to figure out how to pay the sewer bill at the end of the month. And that's a bad predicament to be in. And so I'm not saying mining's the answer. I am saying that we need to allow the state to allow economic development in some form or another in our area. And we really appreciate the process that's going on. I think if we deny this, our villages will continue to die. We've experienced a real out-migration. Our student enrollment has gone from over 500 to into the mid-300s in less than 10 years in our area. That's not healthy. And we really want the idea that our people don't have to give up their culture and roots, but can stay and work and live in an area that we love and that we've chosen to continue to make our homes in. I also want to encourage you that we cannot change operating rules midstream and when projects come along. I fly to Russia pretty often, and I notice over there it's pretty difficult to do business because there's no set standard. You may start out on a path and find out when you get there the guy that promised you something, he's not working there anymore and all the rules have changed. And that's a dangerous situation to let business see this kind of economic irresponsibility, I call it. It's unjust and corrupt, and we condemn that in other countries, and we don't want to become part of that here. The outcome, whether the outcome produces something I like or don't like, it's the process that I think is important. And I love the process that's going on, and I promote that process. We have to be guided by that process, and I'm impressed with the amount of safeguards and foresight that many people who've gone before have put into place so that projects that come in our area get this very, very good and thorough review, and when it's all done, when the facts are there, then we as Lake and Peninsula Borough will take a look at that and we will make our decision at that point on whether the proposal is something we really support or if it's something we cannot support. But we do support the process and we're thankful for it, and we're thankful for the opportunity to come and express these views to you distinguished folks here today. That's all my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Are there questions for the Mayor of Lake and Penn? Representative Ledoux?
You grew up out there, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah, our little community went from 13 people to a little over 100 people now in 50 years.
Mr. Mayor, how many people are on the Borough Assembly?
There's seven people on the Borough Assembly.
And they represent how many different communities? How large of an area is
that? 17 communities. We extend all the way from Ivanoff Bay, which is actually one of our communities that's nearly non-existent anymore, in the south to Port Allsworth in the very far northeast.
How many people live in those 17 communities?
Our latest population data was somewhere between 1,600 and 1,700.
Okay. And we're going to get some feedback from the Lake and Penn elected officials here on you're going to meet on the 21st, is that right?
Yes. I'm sorry, our next meeting with the full assembly will actually occur in Eliamna on the 21st, and this will be on our agenda to discuss and take public testimony there as well. And we will then report directly back to this committee on that. And thank you for allowing us that time to get our meeting together.
Well, it's our pleasure, and it was a concern that was expressed by Representative Ledoux. Do the members of the Lake and Penn Borough I don't know how commerce is generated in the Lake and Penn area. Do members of the Lake and Penn Borough Assembly have economic relationships with Northern Dynasty? Do any of the members have?
I don't know of other members' involvement. I personally have an air service that flies to and from the lake, and we fly. We've been doing it for many years before, and I really don't continue. I don't plan on retiring anytime soon. It's not dependent on Northern Dynasty. We have flown them on occasion, and we have flown folks from the folks that are trying to oppose it as well. We'll fly anyone who can pay their bill.
I'm with you, Mr. Mayor. I appreciate that more than you can imagine. Representative Gatto.
Do I get a discount? Just a question on all of your comments. Were you speaking as an individual who lives in the area or actually representing the assembly?
I'm representing the borough here today.
Okay.
Any other questions for the mayor? Mr. Mayor, thank you very much for flying into Juneau. We appreciate it a great deal, sir. Treffin, are you here?
If Ralph can go first,
please. Okay.
But I can go if you want.
Whatever, whichever way you feel better, sir. You're bigger than me. You get to say.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Co-Chairman Ramos, and Co-Chairman Samuels, members of the Committee on House Resources. I'm here to represent myself. I hold a limited entry permit. I'm a vessel owner, and I've fished commercially in Bristol Bay all of my life. I also serve on several boards in the Bristol Bay region, and I've been involved in Native issues since 1971. I just came from a funeral in Kakanak about 10 days ago, and at that funeral, it was during that funeral that I borrowed my daughter's four-wheeler, who has a four-wheeler in Kakanak, and I went up to the fuel depot, the tank farm, to fuel up because I used it, and I had to borrow her little card lock card because that's how you get fuel up there now. And while I was there, there were some people in line waiting to buy fuel because the pump is common. It's a common pump for fuel and gas. And in order to extract any fluid out of there, you need a card lock. And in order for that card lock to work, you need to have money in the card, and you have to deposit it at the council. The same thing goes with the power. And what that told me then was that the communities have become cash dependent. And it could be because we're a victim of our own success. We have fought for years to improve the quality of life, and lo and behold, quality of life has come in. But there's something that came along with that, and that was the need for cash. And if you don't have cash, then you'll be standing in line, like the gentleman that was behind me, with a little 2.5-gallon Jerry jug, wondering if he had cash in his card so that he can get some fuel at $5.85 a gallon so that he can keep his little Toyo stove going. It was too cold to gather wood. It was about 30 below, snow and blowing, and so they became dependent. And and at that point, I realized that I really am on the right path because I do have a contract with Northern Dynasty to provide outreach and connection. I connect them to the people and connect the people to Northern Dynasty. Nothing else. I don't promote the mine or anything else, and I personally feel that until they can show us that the mine can be done safely, I withhold my judgment. Like what the mayor had talked about, the process is what's going to tell the story at the end of the day. Another story about Northern Dynasty. When I left my job this spring with the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, after 28 years, and lately at the vice president, I left it and went to work for Northern Dynasty because there was a reason for that. Because I served two terms on the State Board of Fisheries, and I also had advocated as my role as vice chairman or the co-chairman of AFN for the subsistence of the people, the people's needs. And in the Iliamna Lake area, the Kwijak has not achieved any escapement, or the Department of Fish and Game has designated that area as a river of concern. And the river of concern definition is what alarms me, because it means the chronic inability to achieve minimum escapement for maximum sustainability. That's what's going on in the Kwijak. 18 out of the last 20 years, they did not get their escapement. Now we have Northern Dynasty coming in to explore and do baseline studies. And what are they going to do? They're going to spend a lot of money, and they have millions of dollars, to find out what's going on in that fishery, because you can bet your bottom dollar that the next time that the Kwijak does not get its escapement and Northern Dynasty has turned the shovel, they are going to be blamed for that. So it's incumbent upon them to find out exactly what is going on in that fishery. While I was on the State Board of Fisheries, I tried to get them to at least examine. Of course, you have the cameo flyover, and that kind of thing, but there's no research. There's no white-collared jackets running around the streams in the dead of winter checking out the quality of the water and the quality of the smoke the way that Northern Dynasty is doing today. So if nothing else that comes of this, at the end of the day, if it's determined that they cannot extract the resources safely without harming that fish, they will pack their bags and go home. In the interim, we will have access to that information. So my thought is, let's let Northern Dynasty go through the process and see NEPA take care of itself. The federal government and all of that has really done well to protect our interest in this thing. When we come to the table and hear all these horrific mine stories, 30 or 40 years ago, you would go to jail today if you ran a mine the way that mine has operated 30 or 40 years ago. NEPA has come along and avoided or prohibited that kind of management. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Are there, and just for the...
You know, I'm not used to talking that fast. I could have done a little more order. I love to talk.
For the record, would you state your full name, please?
My name is Trefon Anguson. Okay. I live in Anchorage, Alaska during the winter. My wife has a house in Kakanak, and I'm a tribal member of the village of South Naknek.
Okay. Are you employed by Northern Dynasty right now?
I have a contract. I don't know if you want to call employment a contract. I don't get in. You know, I just provide, I connect them to the people and the people to Northern Dynasty.
I appreciate very much your articulate explanation.
Well, you've been saying that to everybody that spoke, so it doesn't give me any comfort.
No. Actually, it's just a few. It's just a few if you look carefully. Representative Cotto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Trefon, I haven't said that to everybody that spoke. But I will say I was talking to my colleague on my left here saying, this guy is smart.
Yeah.
Or smart and experienced, or smart and has good information. And so I will tell you that your information to me is important and powerful in that you've been there and you really understand, in my mind, that you do understand exactly the relationship between doing nothing, doing something, and the negative consequences of each one. And so that is the testimony that really we look for in that, gosh, what are we missing? That's the most important part of all this testimony, is for somebody to come forward and say, by the way, the Quijack River. Now, I was aware that this was not having the proper escapement, and we have addressed this question at some length. And some people said, hey, if you got one river that is not meeting escapement while surrounding rivers are, you better be looking at that river and not at the whole process, because the process doesn't seem to be affected. It's the one river. And so I wanted you to say that I certainly am very happy that you were able to come here and talk.
Well, thank you very much for the compliment.
Are there any other questions for our smart?
Thank you very much, Chairman.
Thank you.
And Brian.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Commissioner O'Cleary, if you'd like to come up, I know your time is valuable. We're grateful to have you with us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's a hard act to follow. For the record, my name is Greg O'Cleary. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. My purpose here today really is to focus on the employment picture and the potential employment picture for this project. About 18 months ago, I was called to a meeting with officials of Northern Dynasty, and such is the policy of the Murkowski administration, in any meeting with any potential developer or employer, we lay out the governor's desire with respect to the 90% Alaskan Higher Alaskan Initiative. I found the Northern Dynasty folks to be receptive, and I don't always take people at their word. It's been my history to put people's actions along with what they say. And I have to tell you that we are pleased to report that this particular company has gone out of their way to hire Alaskans. Their current numbers, I think you've seen them for last year, and I'll just put them into the record again. Their total jobs last year were 609. Now, this is a combination of contractors as well as actual employees. The Alaska hire percentage is at 75%. In other words, three out of every four workers or contractors they hired were Alaska residents. Of 609 jobs, 457 were Alaskans. 112 were hired from the Bristol Bay region. And the year-to-date expenditure is $68 million. This year's budget for this particular year is $35 million. Now, why is the State Department of Labor interested in this project? It should be very evident. I think the prior speakers from the Lakin Peninsula Borough, my good friend Mr. Anguson from the Bay, is concerned about emerging economies in rural Alaska. The hopelessness that occurs in many villages today, we need to give people in the villages some hope. You know, we're all cash dependent. Even my friend, Representative Elkins over here, who ran a very thriving industry for many, many years, a local bar in Ketchikan, understands cash. I have to tell you that from the perspective of the State Department of Labor, any employer that comes through the door that's willing to invest in a local hire, and I don't mean just Alaskan hire, but local region hire, is someone that I think we owe at least a mutual trust to assist them in their process. Now, I didn't come here today to beat the drum on either side of this resolution, but I believe, it's my understanding, the resolution requires more delay to bring this project to fruition. I think there are sufficient safeguards within the existing statute, and that any delay in bringing prosperity to that region and to those villagers, in my opinion, is not worth your time and effort. Now, I have to tell you already, this particular resolution has caused some new jobs to be born, and so I thank them for that. I mean, if you had taken a look at the APOC filings for lobbyists about 2 weeks ago and yesterday, you'd have found out this company is creating more jobs for Alaska. So, with that, Mr. Chairman, again, I would urge the committee in their wisdom to not put up another barrier for this company to bring this project home.
Thank you, Commissioner. Excellent summary so far. Any questions for Commissioner? All right, seeing none, thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you. You see, when you do it right, they don't ask you questions.
Ralph, Mr. Angerson, would you like to come up? Are you... Could you state your name for the record, please?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Ralph Angerson. I am the president of the Alaska Peninsula Corporation, which is the largest adjacent private landowner to the Pebble Deposit. The Alaska Peninsula Corporation is made up of five merged villages, Port Hyden, Ugashik, South Naknek, New Halen, and Kakanuk. Today, though, there is a new threat to not only our survival, but we believe to the survival of the Bristol Bay region. That threat is in the form of HCR 29. This resolution is nothing more than a pandering to special interests, to the rich and famous, and powerful outside interests that do not have a stake in the economic future and potential of the Pebble Deposit. It is my understanding that the Pebble Deposit is the richest periphery deposit in the world and that the proposed resolution cites to the same facts. Yet, despite the millions of dollars already expended by private interest to study the deposit and the feasibility to mine, including new studies on the wildlife, the fishery, the biota, and the cultural riches of the area, the private interests who use the land only as a playground proposed to re-study, replan, to lock up all of it for their own personal pleasures. If HCR 29 is passed, then the state's Bristol Bay Management Plan, as it impacts Pebble, will be meaningless. The millions of dollars in studies would like to see will be wasted, and instead the state DNR would be required to carve Pebble from its foundation as part of the Bristol Bay Plan's fabric to spend still more money, which this time will be the state's money. As a result, the research for new sources of power will come to a screeching halt. The very real potential economic development to our region and to our villages will become a pipe dream. The state will waste millions more on studies and designs, money that would be used for infrastructure development, for roads and power to our region. And for what? So that the rich and powerful can come out and play for a few weeks a year, then leave and leave nothing for our shareholders to purchase fuel at over $5 a gallon, so that our children would continue to leave the region because there's no opportunities there for them. The problem, we are told, is that the Bristol Bay Management Plan contemplates only 25% of the riches at Pebble and our now believed to exist. To me, that is not a problem, and it is an opportunity. If I go with a quarter and it turns into a dollar overnight, then I think fortune smiles on me. I don't tear up the dollar and spend more to figure out how to use it. We ask that you wait and see whether the mine is even possible under existing law and technology. APC has taken a wait-and-see approach. We ask the state to do the same. We do not tear up its plan and carve out a new regime for purpose of locking up the riches DNR do not think existed. Please give us a chance.
Thank you, Mr. Angerson. If you'd like to provide us that testimony, we'll make copies of it and submit it to the members if you'd like.
I will.
We'll do that for you. It's always a pleasure to hear what you have to say. Is there anything that any additional remarks that you would like to make, or do you feel that testimony is?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman,
a whole vote.
Okay. I shortened it up a little.
Thank you. You guys must be related. You got the same sense of humor. Are there any questions for the smaller, gentler Mr. Angerson? Any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Angerson. We'll make sure everybody gets a copy of your testimony. How about Scott Brennan, Director for Alaska of Alaskans for Responsible Mining? Please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Scott Brennan. I'm the director of Alaskans for Responsible Mining. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate an extension to perhaps 4 minutes for my comments, if that's all right. Thank you. As I said, my name is Scott Brennan, and I'm the director of Alaskans for Responsible Mining. I have a master's degree in environmental science, and before taking my current position, I taught environmental science and resource policy for 5 years at Western Washington University. And I'm also an environmental science and resource policy textbook author, and in the last couple of years, I've been very fortunate to see my book used at about 100 institutions around the country by over 50,000 students. I mention that because I have, as a result of that work, had a unique opportunity to study resource development proposals, projects, and impacts, both positive and negative, all around the world, including here in Alaska. I'm not an old-time Alaskan. I moved here in 2004 from Bellingham, Washington, and I am a fourth-generation native of Washington State. Alaskans for Responsible Mining is a coalition of nonprofit organizations, and our mission is to ensure that the mining industry in Alaska meets the four criteria set forth by our late Governor Jay Hammond for responsible resource development. And many of you are familiar with these, but just to recap and enter these into the record, Governor Hammond believed that a project that could turn a profit and create jobs was not necessarily in and of itself beneficial to the state. And he argued throughout his life that in order to be beneficial, a project must meet four criteria. Must be environmentally sound, it must pay its own way, it must be supported by most Alaskans, and most important, it must provide the constitutionally mandated maximum benefit to all Alaskans, not just to a select few or a subset. After reviewing HCR 29 and the sound scientific and independent approach it recommends, I support it. I'd like to highlight briefly some of the reasons that I believe it's sound public policy. First and foremost, I think the resolution, reflecting the will I know of many concerned citizens who you've heard from in the past week, exemplifies the role of the legislative branch among the three branches of government, the oversight role and a role of providing the citizens' voice. I also, as many of you know, I'd like to point out the fact that the proposed pebble mine by itself is unprecedented in size, type, and location in Alaska. It's sometimes compared to the Fort Knox mine, but according to data published in the Anchorage Daily News, October 2004, the Pebble mine, gauging the amount of ore processed and the waste generated, could be in the neighborhood of 20 times the size of Fort Knox, and the geochemistry there is also different and presents a higher risk. Also, the proposed pebble mine is really a very small part of potential development, open pit mining development in the Bristol Bay drainages. It's roughly, in terms of total claims, about 10% of what is now more than 1,100 square miles of claims that have been staked in the region. And even though the Bristol Bay plan was updated 2 years to a year ago, even since then, in that short time, we've seen a huge increase, perhaps a doubling in the size of Pebble itself, and approximately the same increase in the surrounding area. And if you were applying for a building permit or had received one a year ago and came back with plans to double the size of your house or your restaurant, you might be expected to revisit the plan and make sure that decisions were based on the most current available information. Also, there are risks associated with open pit cyanide leach sulfide mines, and I'd like to enter into the record a statement from Northern Dynasty's SEC filings June of last year. Quote, unexpected environmental damage from spills, accidents, and severe acts of nature, such as earthquakes, are risks which may not be fully insurable, and if catastrophic, could mean the total loss of shareholder equity. I would also like to mention and enter into the record the fact that in the state of Montana, by Citizens Initiative in 1998, a ban on open pit cyanide leach mining of gold and silver was passed and has since been upheld by the courts. That is here. Also, in 1997, Wisconsin Governor Republican Tommy Thompson signed into law, pardon me, it passed in 97, and he signed in 98, a temporary wait and see measure on permitting sulfide mines. And the state of Montana, the state of Wisconsin declared that until a sulfide mine, a large sulfide mine, had operated for 10 years and had been demonstrated not to adversely impact surface water or groundwater, and a similar mine had operated for 10 years without the pollution of groundwater or surface water, they would not issue permits for a similar mine. They wanted to base their decision on facts on a wait-and-see process. Today, in 2006, that law still stands, and they have not been able to document that. With the minute I have left, I would just like to sum up. Some concerns have been raised about changing the rules and due process and questions of fairness and things like that, and I would like to enter into the record the following statement from Northern Dynasty's 2004 SEC filings, again last June. Northern Dynasty's management may not be subject to U.S. legal process. As Canadian citizens and residents, certain of Northern Dynasty's directors and officers may not subject themselves to U.S. legal proceedings, so that recovery on judgments issued by courts may be difficult or impossible. Mr. Chairman, I'd respectfully submit that based on what we've learned in the lower 48 on statements like this one that I've just read, that this might present an ideal opportunity for the legislative branch with your leadership to play that oversight role and to ensure the citizens of the state the closest scrutiny is applied to this proposed development. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. Other questions for Mr. Brennan? Chair Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Alaskans for Responsible Mining, we kind of asked the last person who had a group name,
yes,
who his membership were. So who are your members?
I didn't bring the list with me, but it is public record and on the website, and I'll mention the ones I can remember. Right now we've got 19 organizations. They include the Bristol Bay Alliance, who Brian Kraft is their founder. He spoke with you on Friday. Kachemak Bay Conservation Society, Alaska Wilderness Recreation and Tourism Association, the Alaska Center for the Environment, SEAC, the Northern Center, the Indigenous Environmental Network, the Center for Science and Public Participation, which was founded by a former Alaskan who now lives in Bozeman, Montana. I know I'm forgetting some, but as due to our C3 status, all of that is a matter of public record, and I'm
okay.
Happy to share.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And also, do you support any mines?
Absolutely. I think that in Alaska today, there are some mines that are doing some things very well.
Actively. I mean, you've said we like this mine.
Depending on what we like to do is point to best practices and use those as examples that could be applied more broadly. As an example, the Red Dog Mine does a great job, has a very high rate of native hire. The Greens Creek Mine has a very innovative reclamation plan in place. The Fort Knox Mine has an outstanding record of water quality control. So that is something we actively monitor and would like to serve in that educational capacity and point out best practices, but also point out areas where we could improve and protect existing Alaskan jobs and interests.
It seems once again that on both sides we kind of lose track of what we're asking for here, the extra level of permitting. Would you, when Red Dog was being developed, have sat in the same chair and said, you know, we need more permitting, we need more permitting, more, the system we have doesn't work, or at Donlin Creek, or at Lucky Shot, or you name it, when an individual mine comes up, do you think that the process in Alaska for permitting mines is broken?
I think that it could be improved.
For all mines?
I think that there are statewide improvements that could be made that would enhance the benefit of the mining industry to the state and reduce the risk to other businesses and downstream users. And that's a conversation I'd love to have. We've actually done a lot of thinking and writing on that, and I'd love to have a follow-up conversation, but I don't want to take up too much time
and
today.
Just a comment, not a question, but we can't lose sight of the fact of what the resolution does and does not do. I don't know if I think that open pit mining is an abomination. I don't know if I think that Northern Dynasty is not ever going to build this mine, or if I want them to build this mine. But I certainly think that the process works. If we're going to fix the entire process, we should fix it for the whole state and not pick and choose and get picked off with one thing or another. That was just a comment, not a question.
Do you have an economic relationship with either Northern Dynasty or Bob Gillum and any of his affiliated entities?
I do not have any financial relationship with Northern Dynasty, and Mr. Gillum's business has made contributions to our organization, less than 5% of our annual budget.
Okay, thank you. Representative Leduc?
Was your organization around when any of the other Alaskan mines were permitted?
I have been around in this capacity since August of 2004. An organization has existed on paper for about 4 years, so we're relatively new. Certainly weren't around at the time of the permitting as an organization of Red Dog or...
You were not or were?
We're not. No, ma'am.
Representative Gatto?
Thank you. The word responsible is very difficult. There is hardly anything we do that doesn't have a side effect. So I guess my question for you is, how do you use the word responsible mining? A mine that only does 10% of the damage that it could have done? Or what do we mean by it?
That's a great question. And I should enter, for the record, Governor Hammond's language on that. We were very fortunate to be able to spend a great deal of time with him. It turned out to be my first year in Alaska and his last. But he attended our last organization's last meeting before he passed away. And we've adopted wholeheartedly and continue to study his work on that. So again, environmentally sound, I think that's something that is certainly open to some interpretation. Maximum benefit to the people of the state. Governor Hickle and Governor Hammond both long argued that unlike the oil and gas industry, the mining industry is not paying fair market value for the minerals, especially at a time today when we're seeing metals at record or near record highs. So I suppose what I would like is not to be the arbiter of what is responsible and what is not, but to encourage this committee and someday DNR to use Hammond's criteria rather than the blunt tool of jobs or tons of gold in the ground and things like that. So I think what I'm after is not a definitive answer to that question today, but that this become the foundation for a much broader statewide dialogue on that question, because I don't pretend to be smart enough to have an answer right now for that. But I think that is one of the most important questions facing the state today with this enormous increase in proposed mining activity around the state.
Mr. Brennan, just a note, you're new to our state and you're so welcome, and so is your expertise, but Governor Hammond may not be with us, but his legacy will be here for generations to come. He was a powerful spirit and remains so. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Scott, I really appreciate the citizens of the state working together for best practices in development of mining. I think that's admirable and necessary. What I'm curious about is whether your organization has a specific read on this particular resolution requiring a detailed management plan in addition to and separate from the permitting process, and how that gets to the advancement of best practices, or if best practices are really set forth and most appropriately expanded within the permitting process.
Okay. I'll do my best to answer that multi-part question. First of all, this conversation we're having, I think, that's a result of a lot of concern that I've heard and I know many of you have heard from potentially affected communities, positive and negative. I think that the fact that this committee is hearing this enables us to have that conversation about best practices. Now, in terms of how this fits into the existing framework, I've done a great deal of homework. I know the DNR staff you've had on the phone. We've debated this. I have a great deal of respect for them. We have different interpretations at times, I think. But it seems, based on the research I have done, that there is a precedent for management plans being conducted prior to permitting within existing management overall and management plans for much lesser projects, for the development of Hatcher Pass, for the Nushagak-Mulchatna recreational plan. So I would say that there certainly is a precedent. I think that if Hatcher Pass redevelopment merits this type of treatment, then certainly the proposed mining district in Bristol Bay could. And I think that that's a question, again, that I shouldn't provide the definitive answer to. But based on what I heard on Friday, and I did listen to all of the hearing via teleconference, it sounded like DNR would be able to conduct this in sync with the permitting process. I don't recall hearing that there would be a significant delay from DNR's point of view. Won't speak for them, but I recall that's what they said, that it wouldn't create an unnecessary burden. Like I said, there certainly is a precedent, and if Hatcher Pass merited such treatment, then this might as well.
Do you have a follow-up?
Just to follow up, I guess I'm trying to get at how best practices, mineral practices, best practices get incorporated in a land use plan that are not incorporated in the mining permitting process and the regulations that go forward there.
Okay. Well, as I understand it, this management plan is site specific. You could adapt the conditions and protections for Bristol Bay to protect those resources, and that might be a very different set of standards than you could you would need to use, say, on the North Slope or in the Northwest.
No. I'm talking about the permitting process, the site-specific permitting process that goes forward under DNR, you know, the large mine permitting process that requires all the environmental best practices, wherever those are, and how this land use plan accomplishes those best practices goals rather than having those incorporated in the DNR's process, large mine permitting process.
Okay. About the DNR's large mine permitting process versus what we're talking about here today, I think a reasonable person could conclude, based on reviewing some materials that I'll enter into the record here, that there is at least the potential for a conflict of interest to exist in a memorandum of understanding that has been entered into between DNR and Northern Dynasty. And I'd like to just read a brief excerpt from a letter from Northern Dynasty's parent company, Hunter Dickinson, September 2004. It says, agreement stuck with the Alaskan government, referring to DNR. It says that Northern Dynasty has entered into an MOU with the state that will govern and expedite completion of the permitting process. Then they go on to say these permit applications will initiate a time-regulated procedure leading to the issue of permits for mine construction, operation, and closure. And that language leads me to believe that perhaps, at least in the view of some, there's a predetermined conclusion that has been arrived at, and that I think would be that concern would be amplified by looking at this attachment to the MOU, which lists agency employees' name, agency discipline, and the hourly rate at which they are reimbursed by Northern Dynasty to, according to Northern Dynasty's parent company, expedite permitting. So I think that this, in conversations I've had with people, the existence of this MOU and its interpretation by Northern Dynasty's parent company has given rise to this call for legislative oversight. So I guess DNR, maybe what I'm trying to say is that DNR isn't necessarily capable of conducting that oversight for itself, and that's it's a functional difference, perhaps. If this were to pass, they would understand that you were paying closer attention.
Mr. Brennan, will you make a let Tim Pound have that so he can make a copy?
Yes.
For the members that's of interest. Representative Ledoux?
Yes, I was just wondering how much of your organization's time is spent directly on the Pebble project as opposed to other mines in the state.
Well, as a percentage, I would say right now probably, and I'm the one full-time paid employee of the organization. So having said that, and you can ask my wife how many extra hours I work each week, I'd say about 20 to 25% of my time is related to Pebble. It fluctuates, I'd say, between 20 and 50, but on average about 25.
Can I just follow up? What sorts of things do you, since you weren't apparently involved in the permitting of the other mines around the state, what sort of activities do you conduct with respect to those mines?
All of our work is done by invitation. So if I haven't received an invitation from a community organization near a proposed mine, I won't be involved, typically. As an example, the Association of Village Council Presidents, Mike William and Myra Nanning, invited me 2 weeks ago to come to Akiak and to offer a public forum, just a mining industry 101. And in that case, it seems like a lot of the villages there are very supportive of the mine, and there's not as much division as I've sensed around Pebble. And so what we provided to them was maybe here are 10 questions you can ask or protections you can put in place to ensure that development occurs on your terms. So it's entirely dictated by the interests of the local communities where I've been invited to spend time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Brennan, we thank you very much for your testimony. Treffin, would you agree that he was an articulate speaker?
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Yes. Is Wasili here, please? Hi, sir. If you would state your name for the record and who you're with, we're delighted to have you, sir.
Okay. My name is Wasili Lichik. I'm the tribal council president. I also sit on a city council and the village corporation board. I'm from the village of Alekinagik. It's the gateway to the Woodtikik State Park, the largest state park in the United States. I was the very first chairman of that Woodtikik State Park Management Council, the first 7 years. In 1985, there were five commercial operators inside that state park. Last year, there was 48. These are lodges. Every one of the employees of those lodges are white. They're mostly blonde. There's eight young men with a six-pack guiding license in the village, but they don't get hired. There's 14 young men now that are sitting in the village with no jobs, that are doing nothing. They're certified as heavy equipment operators, as welders. They've taken all kinds of state, the state training programs, but they're sitting in the village with no jobs. But like I said, all those commercial operators, all those lodges, they don't hire natives. I've called the Alaska Department of Labor here in Juneau. Why they don't hire natives from the villages? They told me they have every right to hire anybody they want. But if you go to Lake Clark National Park, Katmai National Park, all the people are white. We desperately need an economic development in the Bristol Bay region. I'm a permit holder, Bristol Bay drift permit holder. You know, the last couple of years, the season was almost good, but every time the fish hit, it's those American processes that put you on 5,000-pound limit. You know, if you catch 5,000 pounds, you have to stay on the beach for 24 hours. When you see fish jumping everywhere, then when the main one really hits, they shut down. They just let you watch the fish go by at 60 cents a pound. You can't hardly make a living. Last night when we flew in from Dillingham to Anchorage, there was a village, Portage Creek. It was dark. It used to be a village. It has airport. It has a school. But most of the population have moved away because there's no jobs in the village. So last night when we flew over that village, it was completely dark. No one's living there now. I guess they have no fuel, you know, at around the village of electric at gas at 660 a gallon, but the same, you know, for heating fuel. We can't hardly make a living anymore, you know, commercial fishing. We desperately need some kind of economic development in Bristol Bay.
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate your remarks, and I would just caution you as a minority myself to be careful when you're using the words always or never, but your point is well made. Are there any questions for this gentleman? Representative Gatto?
I'm going to step in the barrel here. Is there some reason why lodge owners, you feel they're discriminating because they don't want to hire natives or because?
It's just they don't want to hire natives. I mean,
or is it, I mean, let me just finish.
Dillingham, is it,
Is it because the natives are unable or unwilling to do the work?
No, they don't hire. They hire all the people from the lower 48 states, from Washington State, Oregon, Idaho, California, Wisconsin. That's where all the people come from. They told me they hire all their people in the winter months from the lower 48 states, and they don't need natives.
I see. That's valuable. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming to see us, sir. Lisa Reimers?
I don't have a master's degree.
Yes, ma'am.
And I am not employed by Northern Dynasty.
Okay. Would you state your name for the
record? My name is Lisa Reimers. I was born and raised in Iliamna, Alaska, which is 15 miles away from the proposed mine. And the proposed road is on our land. So we are major stakeholders. And we, as leaders of Iliamna Natives Limited, we were skeptical when Northern Dynasty first came in. And we would like to protect our environment, too, and we would like a safe environment or safe mine, too. But we have to be open-minded because of commercial fishing. There's no longer, you cannot sustain your life living off commercial fishing anymore because of farmed salmon. Farmed salmon is available all year, and commercial wild salmon is only available certain months out of the year. Every year we get our hopes up high about commercial fishing. We think, oh man, this is going to be a great year. We all get packed up, ready to go. Well, it's been 10 years and finally we've given up hope. It costs money to go down there. It costs money to charter a plane. It costs money to get started up commercial fishing. Most people cannot afford to go down there anymore. Unfortunately, we've tried to get into the tourism business. My mother owns a lodge, and we cannot afford a $1 million plane for a beaver to fly out fishermen. We're competing against lodges that are high dollar. They hit the high dollar market for people that have a lot of money. Well, we were trying to get the market where their people could afford to come out and pay, you know, a reasonable price. I've listened to the teleconference on Friday, and I'm a little concerned that the survey that went out, they only surveyed communities that were 70 miles away from the proposed mine. Where was Iliamna? Why weren't we part of the survey process? Another thing is they had this, what did they do, a presentation? Well, who paid for that? You know, we don't have a lot of money. We don't have a billionaire backing us up. Everybody's worried about paying $5 a gallon per, you know, every year for fuel and how to sustain themselves each year. And Iliamna Natives Limited is looking at how do we diversify our economy? Well, if this mine could be safe, and we believe that the state of Alaska could do a good job because they've done it all over the state of Alaska, then we are looking at it, because what other options do we have? We've had certain parties that have stopped a bridge that connected Iliamna to Nundalton. Why is that? You know, when lives have been taken because they have to cross a river that has, you know, they fell through. I'm told to hurry up, so I'm trying to keep this really short. We'd like the process for Northern Dynasty to continue. They have worked well with us in the community. They've given us opportunities. They've hired locals. They've given businesses that may have not survived with the way things are going so far, and they have opened up the doors for us. And they have done a good job with the process of sharing information with their studies, and they've been good neighbors. Thank you for taking the time to letting me speak.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Gatto?
I think you should ask them to give you that four-minute film and put it in your, put it as a disc when you try to sell visitors to come to your operation, because it truly was a remarkable one. It wasn't my question, though. Does this road from the mine all the way to Pedro Bay already exist?
No, it's a proposed mine. It's not a trail.
Because when I was in Illiana, I thought there was some roads that four-wheelers and whatnot were.
They go up to the roadhouse. They go up to the Roadhouse Mountain. Are you looking at the map there? Do you see Roadhouse Mountain on there?
I don't think it's going to be that detailed.
Oh, okay. But there's no trails. I've flown out with Northern Dynasty because we wanted to be part of the process. And they've done a lot of studying on the fish, the plants, the animals. And so I just was really impressed with what they were doing out there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming and testifying today. We appreciate it a great deal. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Eileen Zeiser. Is Eileen here? Mm-hmm. Just state your name for the record, please, and who you're
with. For the record, my name is Eileen Zeiser. I represent myself. I'm a resident of Anchorage, lifelong Alaskan resident, third generation. In general, I support the mining industry. I grew up placer mining. My dad mined in the interior and Hope and Talkeetna Mountains. My grandfather was a miner, placer miner in the interior. And when I first heard or read in the paper about the pebble find, I was excited. It's my first reaction. But a few years later, I find myself a little bit skeptical. This company, Northern Dynasty, doesn't seem to have a track record. This is what I hear. A lot of what I know about this proposed project is may not be accurate, but I urge you, the committee members, to err on the side of caution when considering anything. Too often it seems like there's not enough concern before something happens. It's after. Look at Exxon Valdez and Katrina. And even though I don't have an direct economic interest in the project, I would be indirectly affected if anything catastrophic were to happen.
Thank you for that testimony. Are there any questions for Ms. Zeiser? Thank you very much for testifying before us today. Is Eleanor Johnson here, please? Ms. Johnson, if you'll state your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Eleanor Johnson. I come from a family of 8 girls and 8 boys. I was born and raised in Mount Alton, Alaska. And when I was born, the state was still a territory. This is my first visit here to the state capital. So I'm dating myself a little bit, but I'm doing that because I want you to understand where I'm coming from. I sit before you as a prime example of some of the comments I'm going to make. Out of 8 girls and 8 boys, all but 2 of my siblings still live in the village of Nondalton. The main reason is for employment opportunities. There are no employment opportunities. There's a handful of jobs, but certain people have those jobs, and they work at those jobs every year. Most of them are seasonal. But there's already people to fill those positions. I left due to employment and an education. My sisters and brothers also moved for the same reason, and their children have moved. So that is a really big concern. I left home at the age of 12 to go to school. Things like that shouldn't have to be. Even if I did do that, I still managed to hang on to my subsistence lifestyle. I am looking at 50 years this summer. I have never missed a year out there practicing my subsistence activities. Not one year. And I will do that until the day I die. For many reasons. Because it is who I am. I have concerns, and one of my biggest concerns when I saw this resolution was, okay, what is this resolution saying? Is it saying that the vehicles you have in place today are not adequate? If so, then why reinvent the wheel? Why not just better the process that's in existence? My last question was, then who's going to pay for this? That's still a question that there's no answer to. So that's concern too. And as far as focusing on specific projects, I don't think that's your job. Your job is to take care of all of the citizens of the state of Alaska. And I don't think my people or my children should have to leave home to pursue a living. Okay. We should be allowed to stay.
Thank you very much, Ms. Johnson. Are there questions for Representative Seaton and Cuddle?
I was trying to, maybe I misunderstood. Did you say there were 8 boys and 8 girls, and all but 2 of them are still in the village, or only 2 of them are in?
Only 2 of them are in the village.
Only 2, the rest of
them. They have jobs there.
Right, okay.
There weren't any jobs for the rest of us.
Representative Gatto?
And on another note, you left the village to go to, I guess, high school?
I left for high school. I went to Wrangell Institute, Mount Edgecombe, Shemawa, and the University of Alaska in Anchorage and Fairbanks.
And if I continue, when you... Remarkable. You did all that, then went back to Non-Dalton and had no opportunity to use any of those skills.
I went back to Non-Dalton, and I team taught, although I didn't have a teaching degree at the time, that was my major, and I team taught kindergarten, first grade, and second grade for 10 years. And then I left again to go back to school and got a job with the Anchorage School District. And married and raised 3 daughters in Anchorage. But at the same time, I'm just finishing up 20 years as the president, chair, and CEO of the Village Corporation, although I am not representing the corporation today. So I have a long history with a certain individual that has a pretty healthy bank account. And I've also seen with my own 2 eyes and heard with my own ears that something very disturbing is going on, and I don't like it. I don't think people anywhere should be governed by the person with the largest bank account. And I see that happening, and I think that's a really great concern and should be.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Other questions for Ms. Johnson? Thank you very much for your testimony today. I appreciate it. Martha, please. If you state your name for the record. It's nice to see you today. Thank you for
nice
coming, ma'am.
Nice to see you. My name is Martha Anila, and I'm from Iliamna. I've lived in Iliamna for the past 13 years. I originally come from the village of Kalignik, which is the furthest village up on the Nooshigak River. I am currently employed by Iliamna Pebble Development. It's a joint venture. I don't know if you got a chance to look in your packets, but there's a joint venture with Iliamna Development Corporation and the Chilista Corporation that that worked together in Northern Dynasty Mines as our client. I was hired on as a local hire coordinator in June of 2005. And since I've been hired on through Iliamna Pebble Development, I've seen what Northern Dynasty is doing, all the studies that they're doing on our environment in the area out there, the water, the birds, the air quality, the berries, the plants, and the environmental teams that are coming in there. They are asking, could I get a local person to come out and work with us? And having said that, the people that are hired on from within the Iliamna Lake region, and it expands out to the Bristol Bay, the people that are hired on, they're gaining this knowledge, and, you know, it's nothing, it's something, but it's not like going to get a full course 4-year college and anything, but they're gaining a skill, and it's something that they could add to their skill set. And what I've handed out also is the numbers of people we've hired from the communities in the Lake region and in the Bristol Bay region. And I would like to point this out because this is one of the really unique things for a company to come into our community, and we would hire a person from Togiak. Togiak is way over on the west side of the Bristol Bay. We would hire someone from Togiak, fly them into Iliamna, accommodate them, you know, provide housing, food, lodging, transportation. They're here for their shift. They go back to Togiak. They're there for their time off, and then they come back when their shift's over. Where else do you get that in rural Alaska, where they're able to come out and work and make money and support their families? You don't see that with nowhere in the Bristol Bay. I don't see anywhere in the Bristol Bay region that's doing that for our people. And one of the other things that I do also is, because I'm the local hire coordinator, I push local hire. That's one of the things I really push, because I'll give you one example. Last season, we had two local people in our office. This season, we're going to have three local positions in our office. And one of the positions that I'm really, it may not be a big thing to everybody, but it's a big thing to me, is a bookkeeper position. And that's going to be filled by a local person. More power to us.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions for St. Lon? Representative Moses.
Martha, 5-6 years ago, we appropriated a large sum of money for the Nine Dalton Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been held up by a certain individual. It's a billionaire. I've been told recently that the people of Nine Dalton do not want that bridge, and that's hard to believe.
All I could tell you is the hearsay. I don't know any specifics, or I haven't seen any written material. But not having that bridge there, before, I know from what I've seen and heard in the previous years, people in Non-Dalton and the lake area were wanting that bridge just because to lower the price of gas. And you would not believe the number of people that have died on Six Mile Lake crossing over in spring, and even in winter. You know, there's snow there, and then they fall through the ice, and then they can't be found till the spring. So I don't know why there's a big turnaround.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. That's our honor. Any other questions for Martha? Representative Ledoux?
Two people died there last year, did they not?
Yes, they did.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Representative Gatto?
And if you were to poll the people that are in Non-Dalton now, would you say they're divided on the bridge or significantly one way or the other?
I couldn't answer that because I don't know.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We'll have you come back up. We'll have you come back up in just a second, okay?
You're asking questions about Non-Dalton.
Excuse me. I just want to maintain them. We'll ask you to come back up in a moment. Any other questions, Representative Gunnell? Okay. Any other questions for Martha? Okay. Thank you very much for coming down to testify.
Thank you very
I appreciate
much.
That. You're welcome to come back up and present the answer. If you'd restate your name for the record.
My name is Eleanor Johnson, born and raised in Non-Dalton.
Let's just stay real to the point.
Okay.
We want to try and...
You asked specifically about the bridge and why you believe that people are against it. I don't think that's a true picture. And I was told that... And it doesn't take much to change somebody's mind, especially with this an emotional issue. But somewhere along the way, I believe the tribal council was told that, and I don't know by whom, but they were told that Northern Dynasty was going to use the bridge. That's not true, as far as I've been told. And as soon as they were told that, those people that are quite vocal have just kind of spread the word that that was the truth. It isn't. So all that they do, they're for the bridge. We took a show of hands 1 year, about a half a dozen years ago, a show of hands with the three communities all together, with the Department of Transportation. And the three communities came together, there was a show of hands. Who is for the bridge? Every single hand in that room was raised. We are for the bridge. I have just had a 1 year memorial potlatch on the 5th of this month for my nephew, who's the last two people that went through that river. Many lives have been lost. And the only reason why Mr. Gillum has been filing lawsuits against that bridge is because he says it interferes with his scenic, pristine scenic visual.
Yes, ma'am.
And he can't even see the bridge from there.
Yes, ma'am. We're sorry. We're sorry for the loss of your nephew. Thank you very much for the testimony. I appreciate it. All right. Our last person here that's signed up to speak is Dan from Alaskan Alpine Ventures.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dan Oberlatz. I own a very small adventure travel company in Lake Clark National Park. I'm kind of, Lake Clark National Park blonde-haired white guy. I'm receding in the blonde hair a little bit. Nonetheless, I've lived on Lake Clark for 11 years. Mr. Allsworth, Mayor Allsworth, can testify. I'm one of his best customers, and I certainly understand the cash economy out there. I just had to put 250 gallons in my oil tank, and it cost around $1,500. And incidentally, I owe Mr. Allsworth $1,500, and I asked for his forgiveness for at least a couple months. I'm here kind of to speak from the heart. I am absolutely passionate about the Lake Clark and Katmai region. It is quite possibly one of the world's most perfect ecosystems, home to the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery, the Mulchatna caribou herd. It is a tremendous value to Alaska and to Alaskans. And I believe there's a lot at stake. One, the vibrant tourism economy, an emerging economy that is helping the area to grow. And yes, there are certain issues, socioeconomic issues that need to be addressed when it comes to hiring and local hire and development. But I certainly don't think that risking the tourism industry in favor of a large open pit mine, the largest open pit mine in North America and perhaps in the Western Hemisphere, I believe that that's potentially one of the risks is losing that industry, especially in this age of information. As I said, I believe there are two resources, two competing resources. One is the tremendous ecological diversity and the tremendous resource and ecosystem that is out there, and this large gold and copper deposit. And I'm concerned that one is going to go at the expense of the other. That is why Northern Dynasty owes it to Alaska and to Alaskans, certainly, the assurance that they are not going to have an accident. And in addition to that, I ask you to consider H.R. 29 because I believe that we should scrutinize Northern Dynasty in this project, which is unprecedented in size and scope, under the largest possible microscope that we can to assure that the ecosystem is protected. Thank you very much.
Okay. Are there any questions for this gentleman? Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you. All right, it's 2:45. Everybody has got this document in front of them. I want to try and, as Representative Hawker said when he presented this resolution, wants to stay on the resolution rather than to wander. We've managed to do that to some extent, although I think it was for the benefit of the committee to get a better sense of the scope of this project and its various impacts. Can we go back to do we have DNR online?
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so we appreciate this flow chart. It's very helpful for us. For those in the audience that may not have one, it's we have a series of columns, and on the left side is the DNR large mining permit process, and on the right side is the DNR land planning process, which, if I understand properly, gentlemen, it's the critical path on the right that HCR 29 generates. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So if you'll take a few minutes to lay this out for us, and then we'll open it up to any questions that the committee may have. And my apologies to the various off-nets in Iliamna, Pedro Bay, the village of Levelock, Fairbanks, Dillingham, Kenai. We are not going to likely have time to get to you folks today, and we will take up your comments under bills previously heard as we choose to delve into this again. That being said, gentlemen, would you go through for us? I think you did a fine job on the large mining permit process. Would you go through the land planning process for us and explain to us what parts of this are done concurrently, which parts of it are redundant, which ones generate the particular fiscal note, and anything else that might be germane to our dialogue today?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is Ed Fogles from DNR. And on the DNR land planning process side, again, as you can see, the first two steps are not included, and that's where on the large mine permitting process, the application is submitted and we have to review it for adequacy. So the land planning process would start with the identification of issues and public meetings, which would happen at the same time as the EIS would start its scoping public meetings. And the two tasks are pretty much the same, where staff would go out and try to find out what the specific issues are that each plan and each document should address.
Pardon me for interrupting, Ed. Would they be separate meetings?
We would plan to combine them.
Okay.
And I should caveat this by saying that we have never done a process like this before, so this is our best guess at what this process could look like as it would be intertwined with the large mine permitting process.
Okay.
So we would begin by having public meetings where we'd go out and identify the issues. Now, the issues would be different potentially for the large mine permitting process. Those issues could be very specific to the design. People are going to want to make sure that tailings facility is designed very tightly to withstand earthquakes of certain magnitudes, issues like that. The land planning process may have a totally separate set of issues that might rise up throughout the issues process, such as, okay, now we've got potentially a 100-mile road from Cook Inlet to the mine site. What impacts might that increased access have on adjacent state lands? So even though those two processes would be concurrent, we may have a whole separate slew of issues that might hit us on the land planning side. Then the data collection side would essentially be done under the large mine permitting process, so very little work would have to be done there on the land planning side as we envision it. So that would be, we would rely on the environmental impact statement there. Then subsequent to that, both documents would develop alternatives. Typically in a large mine EIS, you would create a set of alternatives where you might, for instance, put the tailings facility in a different location, and you may have two or three different alternatives with two or three different configurations of the mine site itself, or perhaps a different place that you would route the road, or you might even have different types of access, such as road access or barge access across Lake Iliamna. Now, with a land planning process, those alternatives would maybe even be broader to where, okay, now you've got thousands of acres of state land surrounding the mine. How would DNR manage that land with this potentially significant new development in the area? And so we would develop alternative land management alternatives. Again, then after each of those documents determine alternatives, you would have a series of public meetings, and those would again happen concurrently. And then we would take each document to its final stage and develop a final plan or a final EIS, and each of those would again get a final public notice period. Sometimes those have public meetings, sometimes they don't, depending on the level of controversy. So, but that again, that however that played out, it would most likely happen concurrently. And then the final stages are the tail end. We adopt the documents. There's an appeal process, and then on one side we would decide whether to issue the permits, and on the land planning side we would implement the land plan. So that, in a nutshell, is how the two processes would work. Are there any questions?
Representative Seaton?
Thank you. So I guess what I'm trying to do is figure out the differences here. So basically you're not really looking at this plan having restrictions that would apply to the mining operation itself. You might be looking at, through a land plan, accessory areas, or how the road would affect different areas. But would you anticipate that the land use plan would actually be affecting the mine development itself?
I think the land plan could affect the mine development itself. The land plan would certainly be broader and would take into account some of the surrounding land uses also, but the land plan typically wouldn't, say, for instance, get into the level of detail of whether how thick of a liner one would have to line the tailings pond with, for instance, but it may provide guidance to where you site the tailings pond, how far away from a critical habitat area that tailings pond might have to be. It could conceivably provide guidance for stipulations in that respect.
Can I get,
yes, sir.
And just to follow up then, wouldn't those same things, like the location of the tailings area, be developed in the alternatives for the permitting process? And wouldn't those same issues be related in that process?
Yes, they would. Absolutely. You're correct in that.
Oh, okay.
So there would be a certain, that would be a clear duplication for both documents that we would, it would be very interesting to see how those two documents would play out in that regard.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Ledoux?
Yes, I was chatting with somebody and they suggested that in the land planning process that there might be a provision so that you would be overseeing the building of the mine and making sure that everything was safe there, as opposed to the permitting process. Would that be correct? Would there be anything in one or the other of these processes which would relate to worker safety or whether the mine is structurally sound?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, that process would happen strictly under the DNR large mine permitting process, and that's where the state's large mine team currently, we're very thorough in following up with a mine that we've permitted, such as Pogo or Kensington or Fort Knox, and we spend an awful lot of time following every detail of construction to make sure that that the mine is built as it's laid out in the plans and the approved plans, and that all the environmental monitoring is done as set out in the approved plans. So again, that would happen under the large mine permitting process.
Follow-up. So I want to be perfectly clear that the DNR land planning process wouldn't affect one way or the other worker safety, that this would all be in the DNR large mine permitting process. Is that correct?
Yes, Representative Ledoux, that is correct.
Thank you.
So, Ed, it's Jay Ramers. Let me ask you, in California, they have the Coastal Commission, which is not only responsible for how you build your house and where you build your house, but it looks after things like view sheds, equestrian trails, hiking trails, the impact on oak trees, things of that nature. To a degree, is that the differentiation between these two processes, that the large mine permitting process deals with the mine itself and the permits that are associated with that, and the land planning process is the environmental impact on the greater area and some of these items that are otherwise more intangible? Is that a fair way to process the distinction between these two processes?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn that question over to Director Dick Milius, since he's my planning expert here, if I may.
Thank you.
Representative Ramirez, this is Dick Milius. I think that's a good way of describing what gets added through the planning process, because normally the land planning process would deal with certain more specific items about, you know, where the mine could be or road could be or tailings pond or whatever. I mean, those are things that theoretically could be dealt with through the planning process, but those are things that will already be dealt with through the large mine projects. So the planning process doesn't really add anything to those kind of decisions, but it could deal with some of the more aesthetic concerns or impacts on adjacent land uses or things that are not quite so tied to the actual development of the mine site or are not the quite so technical, that might be more aesthetic type things or and some of the kind of tertiary impacts of the development.
So this HCR 29, because we've heard an enormous amount of testimony last Friday and today, and it's hard to separate the wheat from the chaff on what HCR 29 is, which is how Representative Hawker began his presentation, is his request, and I hate to speak for him, but I'm trying to process this so that I'm clear. We have the DNR large mine permitting process, which is the critical path that this project is on right now, and we are at this point, the application has been submitted, or we're not even to that place yet?
Representative, we are not even to that point. I think the current estimate is that the applications would be submitted at least a year from now at the earliest.
Okay, and I appreciate that, Dick. And then the land planning process, were it to begin, since some of these uses are mixed, it would begin concurrently with the EIS process, the scoping, and the public meetings, because that's something that happens at the same time. You would blend those meetings. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. That's would be our intention. As Ed mentioned, though, we've never done these two things concurrently, so as you can see by the side-by-side, a lot of the steps are very similar, and our goal would be to try to run them together.
So the nature of Representative Hawker's resolution is to initiate it at a point in time when scoping and public meetings on the large mining permit process were beginning, and then at that time you would begin to collect and sift data to determine some of these softer issues that are affiliated with the greater use of that area around Lake Iliamna and the proposed site.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct.
All right, and then they would proceed concurrently at that time, but presumably more people and other resources would be used, and although a lot of the data would be shared, you would in fact generate two reports, likely at the same. Would they end at the same time, or is it just the nature of the way this document looks? It looks like they both end at the same time, but they may begin at the same time, but would they end at the same time, or would the reports be generated at the same time, or would the land planning process, because it's less burdensome, let's say, and I'll ask whether it is more or less burdensome, would it come out sooner or later?
Mr. Chairman, I think our intention would be to try to wrap them up more or less the same time. The on a project of the scale we're talking about, I think the large mine permitting thing is going to have get into a lot of very detailed analysis, a lot of big studies about, you know, dams and how you build them and how you make them secure, and a lot of water quality studies and stuff. So my guess is that the large mine process will take longer than the planning process would if they were separated, but I think our goal would be to keep them together because the outcome of one may affect how we deal with the other one. So I think it'd be kind of essential to keep them side by side.
So if this committee chooses to proceed and move HCR 29 ahead, and it may or may not do it, and the House as a whole, as a body, may or may not do it, and the Senate may or may not choose to take this up, in the event that it did, then this would proceed with a $400,000 fiscal note, and it would generate a report on the softer issues that surround the large mining permitting process for and possibly satisfy some of the concerns that were expressed by people that testified today, both for and against, insofar as assuring the safe use of the environment and fish stock and that sort of thing. This would be an augmentation to the large mine permitting process. Is that right?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think that's a fair assessment.
Okay. Are there any other questions for the folks at DNR? Very quickly, Representative Seaton.
I just wanted to clarify something, and that is, you know, we're talking about the accessory issues here, but those are the large mine permitting process would fully include the environmental impacts, the fisheries impacts, the subsistence impacts to the area, and those things. Is that not correct?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, this is Ed Fogles. Yes, it would. It would include all those resources that you mentioned, and in addition to more, including socioeconomic impacts, air quality, and such.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Before we adjourn today, I want to remind everyone to hold on to their packets. And for those off-nets, you can address this issue through your LIO. Using public opinion messages, our POMS method of communicating, or you're welcome to email me. The LIO that you're at will provide you with my email address, or you can fax your comments to myself at 907-465-2070. 465-2070 is the fax number, and it is 3:02 in the afternoon, and we are resources is adjourned. Thank you very much.